And welcome back to the Such Nerds podcast. This is episode 10 of season 4. And we've been reading The Foundation's Edge by Isaac Asimov. I'm your host for tonight, Peter. Gentlemen, why don't you go ahead and greet our fan?
Jason from Florida.
Woo! And Dan from Los Angeles.
We have a very exciting episode for you guys tonight. It's the last two chapters of the book. And Dan, as always, as our master of summaries, do you have something for us?
Let me reach in the old bag of summaries here and see what I can find. Ah, this one might fit the bill.
Perfect.
Pellerat, Bliss, and Anansi Trevise travel to meet the first and second Foundation coalitions. Novi is revealed to be a Gaian, and Trevise is instructed to decide among the three sides. After a last-minute pitch from both Foundations and some wise words from Pellerat, Trevise opts to side with the Gaians. In the aftermath, both Foundations return home to frame the result as a success. Meanwhile, Pellerat decides to stay on Gaia with Bliss, and Trevise ensures his friend will be well-treated. The story ends with Dom and Trev discussing the decision and agreeing to continue Trevise's hunt for Earth.
Magical, Dan, as always.
Good. That's the last one I got. So there's
things that's all he's got in him this season.
Yes.
He can't do a single more.
All the things I'm allowed to summarize by terms of my parole. We're in luck.
Well, I'm still disappointed for you rolling over on me. Giving yourself up to the police.
But they gave me such a fashionable ankle bracelet, so you got to look at the positives. Yeah, it's a lot happened in this week. When in the nature of a summary, you have to trim out certain things. So there's a lot of meat on the bone for us to discuss.
Absolutely.
We were talking about it before. Yeah, you had a sense that that Novi was kind of the Chekhov's gun the whole season. In typical Eisenhowerian fashion, out of nowhere, it's like mid-sentence and they flip over and he's like, oh, and she's a guy. Not even like a sense of like one sentence in and you're like, oh, thanks. I guess that's the Foundation's Edge approach. But somebody is in line for a prescience award. Multiple people probably.
Yeah. There's a lot of semi-prescientic snippets in our early episodes, I would say.
I think all of us kind of hit a lot of those beats kind of early on.
It's almost like Eisenhowerian beats where you kind of just, it's paint by numbers, but you just get a sense for like, oh, well, this, you know, in general, this character who's not really, you know, it's like a very mule style character arc with her. Well, I think the thing I figured out with all of it is like, well, there's never really a character from left field who shows up and is the surprise. It's always somebody who was sort of there the whole time. Mm-hmm. And so who's left on the drawing board that could be that person. And, you know, it was her.
Yeah. So can we take maybe a step back and just think about some general stuff? And, you know, this didn't necessarily come in from, you know, our fan base, but I think, you know, maybe it's along the lines of the type of things that our listeners might be interested. So when it came to these last two chapters, what did you guys think about the ending? Was it satisfying or did it leave something to be desired? Peter, why don't you start us off?
Ooh, I had strong feelings. I found it predictable. And that was my biggest letdown is I felt like it was kind of mashed together at the end. I still don't feel like I have a good understanding of why our boy, Golan. Golem. Why was Golem the golden boy? And I guess like,
because he's got certitude, something, you know, a few things about, you know,
I'm gonna pretend
right.
Like I do. So it's, I guess he has like some kind of instinct that they valued, and somehow like that was supposed to leave the fate of the universe in his hands. But I don't know, I guess because he was a first foundationer who had intuition, who like wasn't trained by the second foundation, maybe that's why he was a key player, but it just felt very contrived and I didn't get a good feel for like what made this guy special.
So generally, Peter, you would say that it wasn't as magical as you expected, knowing this was an award-winning novel. Is that what you're trying to
say?
Right.
It didn't hit hard, right? And then I kind of like was thinking about it like later after I finished reading it. I was mad when I finished the book. I'm just going to go ahead and say that. I was like, "What? What is this?" It's like, this is terrible.
Now I have to read the next book and find out.
Yeah, let's what's going give him a 72-hour cooling off period before recording the pod. Is very important.
Right. Yes. Yeah. So then I was thinking about it later, and I was wondering how much of it would have like melted my mind if I had just like plowed through the book. Uh-huh. Like, and the other problem is because this series is so well known, like a lot of these concepts and ideas have already been like established in like the greater works of science fiction, right? So like the concept of like, I don't know,
the connected planet Pandora, connected planet in James Cameron's Avatar.
The idea that there's like robots among us, right? And that we're all like living together in some kind of harmony, or that that these humans are so convincingly, or these robots are so convincingly human that they can be disguised. Like,
hold on, what are you talking about? Dan did not mention anything about a robot in his summary. What are you talking about?
Leave it somewhat open.
Can you elaborate a little bit on that?
Well, it's pretty heavily implied that one of our main characters, or that our character Bliss, is a robot. Right. She gets interrogated at the end.
She's very evasive about it.
She's a robot, right?
Not answering in a way that implies she's got something to hide.
Right.
She's basically pleading the robot fifth the entire conversation.
And so she like there's this like back and forth play of like her saying like she never actually directly answers the question. Right?
She says, "I'm not a robot. You're a robot."
She's like, "Do I look like a robot?" There's a scene from Parks and Rec. And he's like, I like being a witness when it comes to testifying, but the only type of witness I'll be is a hostile one, and I'll answer every question with a question. Are you being hostile?
I would say that I am.
Let's give Dan. Dan, what? Hold on. Let me interrupt you, Dan. Why don't you take the floor, Dan?
I buy my applause box to play Peter off the scene.
Yeah, there you go.
Similarly, I mean, nonplussed is how I would describe. You know, it's like he kind of punts. He's like, tune in next time when our hero. It's like he just literally like pivots at the end, and there's no payoff. The payoff is read my next book, and maybe you'll find out then.
Right,
and then it's like,
there's peace for now.
Yeah, exactly. Like, oh, and a crisis was averted by punting into the future. It's like,
right.
Yeah, I had the same thought that like I was expecting because of the, maybe apparently I might have read a nasty letter to the Hugo Awards, like 437 years later, being like, guys, Scully screwed me over. I assumed you awarded some prestige and it would be this fantastic book. It turns out it's just a complete sham because, you know, it wasn't that exciting.
I might have to ask you to walk back a little bit of that rhetoric and just maybe think in context about the book in its entirety. Was it a complete sham, or because you are a kind of budding expert in Asimovian text, do you approach the book with a less kind of naive or innocent readership than the average reader?
I guess I've just grown some used to performing as a complete Asimov amateur. Now that I guess enough amateurish performances, you become somewhat of a learned authority. But no, I'm only half kidding. It doesn't seem like a very resounding conclusion. And it just there's one slight reveal that Novi is kind of a third foundationer in the ways we were talking. they get picked, and you know, the big mind trick is that you sort of pick the winner and the losers still think they won. The old win-win scenario. And then it's like, oh yeah, sure. Now I'm going to keep going for Earth. So maybe after the next book, you'd be like, oh, well, then it ties more stuff together. But I take your point, Peter, a little bit that it feels like he just kind of like, I was expecting there'd be a lot more runway. And then you're like, oh wait, there's two chapters left. Like, how is he going to tie up all these endings? Mm-hmm. Right. And the answer is he's not going to.
Yeah, and it was just kind of, it literally doesn't even come to like the reveal of how he comes to it. It's like hard, it's like, and he came to a conclusion, and then hard cut, and then it's like the aftermath, right? Mm-hmm. And there's not like, it just seems like you broke off right before the swell of the tension to like cut hard away. Where's all the exciting stuff? Like there's, you know, and I guess the tension is supposed to be built between the first foundation and the second foundation, but they both struck me as like so inept, like as characters that I felt no tension. And I was like, I really don't care if either of these guys blow this, each other away. I feel a little bad for Novi. Like, she's all right.
You know? How much of your dissatisfaction was rooted in the fact that you wanted everyone to lose? The same thing comes out, be like, I hope there's a giant asteroid, just wipes them all. Hopefully the ships are close enough, and there's a tragic sort of like clip each other. And they,
all of a sudden, the Chekhov's like four-way comet comes out of nowhere. It just like blows up all the ships.
It's not a Chekhov's comet because it's not in plain sight the whole time.
It's not like, we'd have to get hit by four different asteroids at once.
Yeah, exactly. That's you're 100% right. I totally forgot about that. It would be brilliant if they did that. Like, oh, turns out statistical improbability. It's like four asteroids in four different dimensions. The computer is like controlled by somebody else and it basically just triangulated them to the point where four asteroids are coming together, and then basically like perfect. Everyone's dead.
Let me give the stage to somebody who hasn't had a chance to speak yet. Jason, why don't you go ahead and give us your take?
Yeah, you're the host, Peter.
I'm the host with the most.
Well, thank you, Peter, for your consideration. That's very,
of course,
very kind of you, and our favorite editor. A lot of what you guys are saying, you know, is true. And for me, it was like a flashbang ending because he went and built up to this point where there's all this pressure on Trevise to make a decision. And then there's only like, you know, there's only a handful of pages left after that to really kind of unfold the aftermath. And like you're saying, Peter, he goes like from pre-decision to post-decision, and then you learn about the decision through the aftermath. I feel like, I know you don't want to bring the reader to the climax too early in the book and then have like 19 chapters of epilogue, like we talked about early on in this season. Right. But at the same time, I feel like he could have had a solid chapter for each of the three players, right? He could have had a somewhat elusive or evasive aftermath for the first foundation by themselves. And it's like, leave you questioning, like, well, what about the other guys? And then he could go to the second foundation. And then he could go back to Gaia for another chapter. He could probably do three chapters at the end post-decision to really kind of wind it down more cohesively. That is how it was presented, I think it's a very well put together book. And I don't know if I would call it Hugo Award. I don't know much about the Hugo Award. I don't know if I would give it an award for greatness, but I would say
first best times.
I don't know. I thought it was a Hugo Award winning.
I could be wrong.
First Good Times book.
Yeah.
First Good Times book. They got the Good Times Award winner.
That same thought. It's like he wrote the book, and then he like he found out, wait, it's due tomorrow? And he just like,
I crammed everything in the last five paragraphs.
I got three more parts to deliver, guys. Better sign that contract. I'm going to need another $10,000 per book.
The whole context at the end was really hard for me because they were all bad paths, right? It's like voting for president. Like you only have bad choices. It's like you're trying to pick which is the least worst choice, right?
Right.
And I think that's ultimately why he picked the choice that would allow him to basically punt into the future, which I get, it makes total sense. But it was really hard for me to kind of work with that. It's a fictional story. It shouldn't be that hard to conclude.
I feel like there was a missed opportunity as far as the structure is concerned. And you bring up a good point, Jason, about that there could have been a chapter for each one of those kind of scenarios. And it would have gone like in the third book in the series,
where
we had like
the other end of the spectrum.
here's the chapter, right? And you're like, okay, this is obviously the conclusion, and it's the first, you know, first Foundations chapter. And then, you know, they cut away and, oh, this is actually the real ending, right? The second Foundation manipulated their way out of the scenario, right? And then, like, maybe they kind of vaguely address what happened to Trevise and, you know, what happened with the, you know, the third Foundation slash Gaia. And then, boom, here's the real, here's what actually happened. And then you have, like, kind of like a half chapter of, like, Bro being like, okay, I'm going to go to... Yeah, the cliffhanger. Like, I'm going to go find Earth, and I'm going to leave you here with your robot on Gaia.
When we went through the last book where there was all the fake endings, you were kind of annoyed that there were so many fake endings. So, you know, think about it in the temporal sense, after having that last book come out and, you know, that sort of ending structure, he probably is not going to be like, well, let me do the same thing.
Right.
Might have been a pendulum thing where it's you swerved back the other side a bit too much. You probably should have drawn it out a little bit more.
The view shifts of the different characters would have been more interesting, right?
Yeah.
And instead, I felt like we got one view shift. Like, we got the first Foundation. We're, like, pretty solid. I don't feel like we got the second Foundation, like, perspective very much. At least, like, not as strongly as I would have liked.
Because they were, like, on the way, right? He was on the way back. The first Foundation, they went back, right? Didn't they have them back in Terminus already? I can't remember exactly now.
No, I thought they were on their way back from the...
Were they also on their way back?
Station, okay. And, yeah.
But it was like a more elaborate ruse, right? Their whole thing was that they had this, like... They were doing the victory dance because of this great, you know, feint that they pulled with the Seychellians, but there was like a feint within a feint, right?
They pulled them into the Foundation. They were previously not in the Foundation. Now they're part of the Foundation. So it's like, oh, look at this big, you know, got Wake Island. Fantastic. You know, like,
yeah, I interpreted it as that.
But like, yeah, hey, great. Thanks.
I mean, are they part of the Foundation or did they just kind of crack them open? Like,
I wasn't sure if it was a peace treaty with them so that they were like, you know, Foundation credits and Foundation whatever ambassadors and, you know, Foundationers.
It was like, what was it, like Commodore Perry Nixon with the black China. Ships when he opened up the trade with Japan or something like that?
Right.
Was that, am I or thinking of the right one?
Went to China.
Was it Commodore Perry?
I think you're right.
And so they opened up trade. Basically, they conquered the isolation, right? Even if they didn't become part of the...
They didn't become part of the Empire.
They didn't become part of the first Foundation, but they basically became part of an actively trading universe where the first Foundation is the ruling Empire, basically. So it's they may as well be part of the Empire.
I'm glad he picked the Gaians because I guess it's like the devil you don't know. We already know we can't stand, you know, the second Foundation guys. And first Foundation, you know, I've never been sold by Brano with her foot on the gas pedal, foot on the brake, foot on the gas pedal.
Right.
Sort of like that's a good operating.
Analogy. I was going to, like, how was he going to describe her?
Like, her hard heel turn.
Yeah.
From calculating, like, mastermind to, like, bloodthirsty savage.
Like, manic neurosis.
Jekyll and Hyde. Yeah. You know, it's very, and so we don't, like your point, we don't want to use these people. You know, it's, but that's the analogy. It's like you have a military sort of like Foundation that would end up, you know, fighting and having that aspect. And you have just sort of the sort of entirely sort of mind politic approach of the second Foundation. And both of those options are going to be the, what they talked about in the Seldon Plan before, where it's like half a loaf that it would feel good in the moment, but would eventually fall short and you'd be right back where you started from. And then the Gaians offer something else. The, RC Cola of Foundation options, I guess you'd call it. But
right,
I want to see a Seychellian Union uprising. That's what I want to say.
Well, you know, they kind of like glossed over the Seychellians, right? They treated it's like they're like Poland in this book, right? They just get walked through to get back and forth to Gaia, right? And so maybe they actually eventually do, you know, play a more active role.
I wish we had found out more about the mule. Like, because now we know that he came from Gaia, right? Mm-hmm. And he's obviously like, I don't know, some kind of bad egg or whatever. Mm-hmm. But like, and I believe his upbringing story about how he was treated badly and like he was like looked down upon and whatnot. And then he didn't realize that everybody had the same powers that he had. And so I don't know if he like somehow escaped when he was really little. And then he grew up like kind of just being battered and beat up by other people like that were not connected to Gaia, or if he was like Guyanese and then he like left, like somehow got escaped the planet.
Guyanese.
Yeah, he's Guyanese.
Well, ultimately, and where does his muledom fit into that? You know, it's like,
right.
Is there some sort of backstory there? And I don't know. Maybe somebody knows more than us. This might be addressed somewhere else. But
yeah, I don't know, because he had that obsession about like trying to conquer the second foundation, right? Like he wanted to conquer the first foundation, then he wanted to conquer the second foundation. And if you think of Gaia as like a super organism, right? Like maybe he was just like a cancerous cell that somehow like broke off and like went rogue, you know, like a. Like part of the immune system that flared up. And
well, we've literally, like, supposedly this planet is this ecosystem of beings that are all in harmony.
It's harmony,
We've only met three of them.
Right.
And only two of them are actually organisms.
Right.
Right.
Two of them are real.
So
two?
It's Dom and Novi.
Oh, right, Novi.
Well, for all we know, Novi is a real human, but maybe...
Yeah, I think she is human.
Maybe, who knows, you know? But we think Dom is, right, based on Trevise's exchange with Bliss. Right. Novi is still maybe a question mark, but...
No, Novi's
human. It's like... There's still a lot of mystery about Gaia that we don't know, right? And the mule has made enough appearances subsequent to his demise... that there might be more illuminated later in the series.
Right.
But before we get too far down some of like the nuts and bolts of the chapters themselves, now that I've asked the question about what did you think of the ending, I'd like you to try to imagine that you hadn't read an Isimov novel for 30 years.
Right.
And you read Foundation's Edge. What would you, would it be like... All of this, like we've been talking about old Isimov versus new Isimov, this like ending is very much, it's a spin on old Isimov, basically, right? Or traditional Isimov, I don't know, whatever you want to call it. Would that be classical, more nostalgic and feel nice to kind of have that experience again in a new story? What do you think?
You know, I think it's probably more interesting to think about it from the concept of like, what if I had read all of Isaac Asimov's work up to this point? Because this is kind of like a unifying novel for his like two series, like his two kind of, you know, cornerstone series, right? You have Foundation and then you have the Robot series, right? And then you have robots in the Foundation series. And it's even like alluded to like the fact that this is all part of like a singular universe. So like when this book came out, like we are inundated with multiverses now, but like even 15 years ago, the concept of a unifying universe for all of these different stories was really, really interesting. Like it was like mind blowing. Like Stephen King's done it with the Dark Tower series, and he's tied in like little like seeds of that into like a lot of his works, and it's always really exciting as a reader to be like, I know what that is, that's like part of the Dark Tower, or like in this case it would be like, oh wow, that's like part of the Robot series, and it's in the Foundation series and they're in the same universe. Like that would melt my mind, right? And I could see how that would be really exciting.
I agree, but it's hard to do that because it's like, you know, conceptually 35, 40 years in the future, there's much less that's surprising because of the place in the world and the culture. There's things that like people would blow people's mind because it didn't exist before 1985, you know, that nowadays people have seen, and they've sort of just technological marvels that people of that time frame wouldn't ever possibly imagine that or take it to be entirely commonplace and rudimentary in this point in time. So the capacity for surprise, but also the capacity and willingness for people to like wait for a reveal. And like a lot of that doesn't exist anymore because of the instant gratification culture that exists in the modern day.
So like, I think that's another part of it too. Like people are more, much more willing to wait for it back then than they would now.
Yeah. I think they probably like the anticipation probably had a lot to do with it too. Right. Like, oh, he's writing a new novel. Oh, he's going back to Foundation. Like you'd be reading your sci-fi periodicals and getting like your hype game up, and it's, you know, takes two,
it's
3 years.
It's just another autobiography.
So Peter, can I ask it before you make your statement, I just want to confirm, would you have been happier if you had been presented the entire Asimov Foundation's Edge in a 14-second TikTok video?
Absolutely. Jason's ragging on my love of TikTok.
It's
but here's the thing I wanted to say, Dan, is that you said like a lot of these people wouldn't be impressed because of what exists today. I would also argue the point that like some of these ideas Isaac Asimov put into the mainstream about what was possible, like as far as like the interactivity of like a computer and a person, right? This was, you know, somebody probably thought of it, but it probably wasn't as widely, like as widespread because of like the distribution of this book, right? This acted as like a broadcaster essentially of those ideas. And then those ideas, like once somebody has an idea like that, it kind of like you can start building towards it. So you could argue that like this book has helped influence modern culture by and like technological development by saying like, you know, this is what it could look like. I mean, look how far we've come for robot technologies.
I mean, you guys, you know, I don't know if you guys are into Elon Musk per se, but apparently he mentions heavy inspiration from Asimov's Foundation series for
right.
his adventures in his business startups.
Well, like as a robot, I would think that he would be really inspired by it.
Is he a robot?
he might be an alien.
I mean, if he's an alien, he could be a robot. Genius than he is a robot. That's you know. And he bought all these companies. He didn't start any of these companies. He just bought them.
Oh,
all.
Yeah. He can't, like even Tesla, he jumped in on it early on and then kind of muscled it.
I mean, there's a skill in that. Don't get me wrong. He definitely has a skill in hype. He definitely has a skill in sort of like picking companies, but you'd be like, he's Tony Stark. It's like, I guess.
All right.
What about you, Jason? I get myself kicked out of California.
Jason, you asked the question.
Yeah, I did. I did.
Answer the question.
I think, you know, if I had read, if I was around in the 50s and read the first three books.
You were terrible.
You'd think I was.
Elder you know, Slam.
Who knows? And if I read it in the 81, 82, when does it come out? 81? If I read it in like 82.
I thought I was wrong.
That would have been
we
like,
ask this question every week. When did this book come out?
I thought it was 84, but I probably.
I thought it was 83.
83. We're all wrong.
82. I was right.
82.
So
you're right in when you said 81, but hey.
Was it 81, 82?
Closest to the number without going over. Price is
God Emperor was 81. This was 82. Yeah. Okay. So I think. In any case, if I had read this in 82.
Okay, you and I can talk as old people. Peter was not around this time frame. Right.
I know. I'm familiar with you know, this is pre Peter. BP.
BP.
Before exactly. Peter.
Right.
Nice. Right.
We're restarting at zero, by the way, on my birth year.
It was 2BP, right?
And now it's the AP. It's after Peter.
Yeah, yes. I think this would have been much more mind-blowing, like the idea of computers being very novel at the time, no pun intended, and being able to navigate a ship through space is a kind of a cool, like autopilot was probably a cool idea at the time. The tiny wayfarer would have been very interesting, right? You know,
mm-hmm.
And I think the structure of the novel probably would have been, you know, I kind of said it before, but I bet it would have been a little bit nostalgic, right? It would have been a taste of old Asimov after years of drought, you know, and probably would have taken it okay. I'm not sure if it wouldn't have left me wanting a little bit for some more meat on the bone in the very end, but I think I would have really appreciated it if I had read it kind of in its own time, if you will.
Yeah. Yeah, I would agree with that too. I just, you know, I found the pacing at the end unsatisfying.
Well, there was, I mean, it's a lot of buildup, you know, and
it's a lot of buildup.
It's back, back and forth, and like there's the whole narrative he used, and he just like it ramps into a brick wall.
Right. And then he chooses Gaia because, you know, it's the only decision he can undo. Right. Like he can always tell the other two.
He chooses Gaia because it means he gets to write two more books, you know, essentially is what it comes down to. I mean, which is fine because
it keeps us busy. Right.
I've already read the intro to the next book.
You've what?
Mm-hmm.
You read ahead.
You heard me. It's not ahead because it does. It's pre. It's not before page one. So it's not ahead.
I haven't even read the title. What's the title of the next book?
Foundation
and Earth.
E-Earth.
Yeah.
And E-Earth? Okay.
E-Earth.
I wonder if they'll find Earth and E-Earth.
Foundation and Earth. That's the stated goal. It starts literally right immediately after this one ends. So
we met Trevise, like, first paragraph of the book, and we're going to follow him into the next book, right? Is this a first for Asimov? In the series? Well,
it happened at the, I guess...
the mule. We followed the mule and Pritchard.
Yeah, after
they overlapped the end of one book and the beginning of another.
After the whole Beta Terrell circumstance, then it was like, oh, it's the mule is now all-powerful in his mule kingdom. But it wasn't immediate like this, but it was still like the same character arc. Mm-hmm. But yeah, not like this where it's like, oh, it's like it's the same book and it's just the next chapter. But I didn't know the time signature of it. But I mean, on the one hand, for me, I was like, great, because I got a lot of questions. So
glad, you know, unanswered questions there, Mr.
There's
Asimov.
More book.
Yeah, great. There's you know, there's more meat on this bone. You punted, and now we're sufficiently downfield where we can, you know, field the punt and move on. So
our listeners just joining us, Dan is always concerned about how much meat there is on the bone.
Speaking of meat on the bone, we didn't really talk about the buildup in the decision chapter, right? We're kind of like set up with all our characters, all our duos have been brought to the fore, right?
Mm-hmm.
And the decision chapter really kind of pulls them all into the same, like, you know, the nexus of the decision is like the center of the future of the universe, right? Pulls them all together.
No big deal.
But did you have any thoughts going through the decision chapter, like following the various paths and the tracks?
It's almost like I didn't even have the opportunity then, this one, because it happened so quick. You're like, oh, well, okay. You know, I had a sense you would pick Guyan just because, like, when they set it up and the first foundation is saying the first foundation stuff and the second foundation is saying the second foundation stuff, mm-hmm. It's almost like, well, of course he's not going to pick either of these two because they're so polar opposite. You know, it's a third way type of decision. But I felt like I sort of almost missed the opportunity to sort of think about it that way because it happened all so abruptly.
Mm-hmm. But I think you're right, Dan. Looking back, I didn't probably realize it while I was reading it, but it did feel like, you know, even though the Guyans were saying like, oh, we can't influence your brain, you have to experience this for yourself. And they said all that, but, you know, at the same time, they had kind of planned out this whole thing.
Yeah, they contrived the whole scenario.
Yeah,
all
that's
there,
exactly what
kind
was
of
meddling with my mind would say.
Why would you ever do that if you thought there was a chance that you wouldn't be chosen, right? You knew that the first foundation is currently led by this, like, history,
the lady from South
historical
Park.
Reference, yeah, hungry leader. You know that the second foundation is about to, like, turn over to this climber, basically, right?
Wonder
this ambitious climber. And these are both kind of bad paths, right? And we had these echoes throughout the book even of, like, wow, that's, like, doesn't sound like good from the second foundation, that they're, like, clawing at each other to get to the top of the bucket, right? As
people 600 years, and this is what we've got.
Dolores? Delarmy?
Dolores.
Dolores Delarmy is her name.
Dolores
Delarmy. And I kept calling her Delmari.
Delmarva.
But it's Delarmy. Yeah.
Delarmy.
It's and then it's First Calamari. Foundation, you got this Brano, right, who's like cold calculating, suppressing, you know, Trevise.
And also Manic.
And Manic with her, like, all of a sudden she's like, I need to be in the spotlight. You know, I've been in the shadows for years.
Yeah, I've been playing politics for so long. Yeah. What have I been doing? So what have I wasted my life doing?
So, of course, we don't want either of those to lead the galaxy, right? But at the same time, like, the Gaians are, you know, basically sheeple. And so is that really what we want for the future of humanity? I don't think so. But
do you think that he wrote those, now thinking back on it, how much we were like, oh, God, these people are terrible. Do you think he wrote them that way, spread the gap for the third way to come in?
I'd like to give him the benefit of the doubt and say, hopefully, yes, he did that on purpose.
He's not writing it like, these people are fantastic. Let's keep going.
I don't know. Like, from the perspective of, like, the Gaians, right? They basically contrived this whole event. It sounds like from the beginning, right? That's kind of like the implication. Why?
So they said that now was the time and they happened upon this Trevise character. And to go back to your question earlier, Peter, which was you kind of segued into the same zone, is why really was Trevise important, right? And I think that's kind of the answer is the same as why did they contrive this whole series of events, right? They identified this Trevise character who, if you look back at from the very beginning, he was antagonistic to the First Foundation, right? He was antagonistic to the Second Foundation at the same time. And then he meets Bliss and he's immediately antagonistic to the Third Foundation, the Gaians, right?
Right.
So he's kind of cynical or at least skeptical of everybody he encounters. And they make it a point to say that he is the one who can choose because he knows what is right. I think he's cautious about everything and he's judging the whole world with the same kind of cynical viewpoint that I could see it being a benevolent maneuver on the part of the Gaians. Like, they know there's a crisis coming and they want it to be,
they'd like pre-trigger it
to be, you know, determined by an independent party. So they bring in this kind of fourth player, right? This independent individual.
It's almost like they couldn't do it, right? They couldn't decide for themselves. Like maybe yeah, more.
That might be the thing, you know?
Maybe the whole, like the whole thing, the planet itself is that, you know, yeah, there's people intermingling, but like the robots are the ones in charge, like, you know, basically acting as buffers to allow the humanity to continue to evolve, but not necessarily restrain humanity. But at the same time, like when they get put in charge of like a major human decision that's going to affect the fate of humanity and potentially cause mass suffering, like the robot laws kick in, right? It's the same reason that Bliss couldn't be direct about, you know, whether or not she was a robot, right? It's like, you know, are you a robot? Do I look like a robot? Like, do you think the Gaians should rule the galaxy or the First Foundation or Second Foundation? Do I look like I should decide that? You know. So they had to get like someone who's genuinely human, right? Like, you know, someone who's genuinely human to do that, right? I don't know.
I hear you. And then at the end, I think it's funny because in the third book, we learn about the second, or it's about the Second Foundation. The fourth book is about this kind of Third Foundation, right? Mm-hmm. And then it opens us up for the next book, which is like, well, if the Second Foundation didn't delete all the Earth records and the Gaians didn't delete all the Earth records, who deleted all the Earth records? And like, even within Gaia, you've got kind of two foundations, right? Like, you've got the Gaian people, but you've like Gaia as a
like a collective,
metallic collective, right? You've got the human collective of Gaia, but then mixed into that, you've got this other layer of the robot collective of Gaia.
But it's all one, Jay.
It's another layer,
all one.
But it's not, because Bliss was able to segregate herself from certain interactions, right? Wasn't that what Trevise latched onto? He's like,
they all have their own ability to do that, was my impression, right? Because Novi could do it, right? She was separated, and she was like, she still felt the loss of it, but she had like separated herself from the collective, right? So, but I think
makes me question now, maybe she is also potentially inorganic.
I don't think so, because I think part of the thing with Bliss was that she didn't join them for meals, right? And so
she couldn't eat, but because she ate on the spaceship, remember? She was like, it wasn't because I don't eat.
Right.
But that made him suspicious nonetheless, right?
Right.
But what she said was that he said, can I speak to you like outside of, can you turn off your access to Gaia? And she could. And he said, that's right. How I know you're a robot, because if you were human, you wouldn't be able to turn it off or something like that. Right.
Yeah. That left me with a lot of questions. You know, it's like he was trying to pin her down. Trevise had this idea about what she was and what she is. And she's very evasive about it. And he's like, well, you're evasive, which means that you're telling me this. And maybe, but then again, maybe not. You know, it's never clear as to the provenance of what the actuality of it is. And which is fine. I mean, I'm sure we'll find out more about it in the next installment. But he's certainly decisive. He seems to have his good points. Seems to have, you know. But in the same time, he's like flipping out the whole beginning of the chapter because, you know, he's like, I'm not nervous. What are you talking about? I'm super tough, you know?
Oh, yeah.
It's just like.
And then he's like mad about like the impedance on his own choice, right? Like, or yeah, like, it's like, any kind of subtle like, manipulations that he may have been privy to.
Yeah, Pellerat's like totally straight. He's like, I get it. It makes sense that you're nervous. Like, you're in a possible situation and totally unreasonable. And he's just like, no, I'm not. I'm not nervous at all. I'm totally cool. And it's just like.
Yeah.
Whatever you say.
You're nervous.
Yeah, I'm not nervous. You're nervous. I'm not crying. You're crying, Pellerat. No.
Brings up to Bliss that Bliss influenced Pellerat to raise the point that ultimately led to his decision, even though he claims that didn't lead to it, but he like pins Bliss down like, well, you influenced Pellerat, who reminded me of something. She's like, but it was just already in his brain. All I did was pave a path for it to come to the surface, you know, like... So yeah. They're definitely influencing, even though they're claiming
all
not
I
to
did
influence.
Was inception him.
It's like the gravitational force.
Oh my gosh, that movie was unfollowable.
Which movie?
Inception.
Oh, Inception.
Yeah,
I have it
on Blu-ray. I've never actually watched it.
Oh, it's so good.
My favorite of the Christopher Nolan's is The Prestige, and which is also
Prestige is great.
Impossible to follow, but. Like the third time I watched it, I'm like, I
get it now. Yeah, I had to watch it twice.
I'm not sure what else we want to kind of delve into here. We've got. Is that one of you guys?
It's my phone reminding me I have a meeting at 1 p.m. tomorrow.
Oh, it's nice.
Like, what are you doing? It's 7 o'clock the night before.
Somebody put it.
Kind of convoluted. Freaking
somebody put
reminder
a 1 day reminder, like 9 hour reminder or something.
That's a preposterous amount of time. It's like, it's 18 hours from now. Like, what are you doing?
So, I mean, I'm not sure what else we want to explore here. We've got, they built up to this decision where you've got First Foundation with Codel and Brano, Second Foundation with Trevise and his now influencer of Gaian descent, Novi, Sura Novi. Then you've got Pellerat and Trevise, who are kind of like, they're kind of out, like they tagged out of First Foundation. They're like, we're on our own. We have our own, you know, mind or whatever, I guess. And
they're
and
like,
Bliss,
I don't give a puff of comet gas.
Yes.
That's what they said.
That's going to make its way into my lexicon.
Then it's like, you know, Trevise is like, he's built, all the tension is from Trevise by himself. Cause it's like, everybody else is just kind of like kind of like looking at each other across the table, and Trevise is like, he's like banging on the table, like freaking out, you know, like he's got to make this decision. And then all of a sudden it's walls. Like yeah. convoluted aftermath of the First Foundation scheme with their trade with the Seychellians, and then the Second Foundation, like, I guess he goes home like all victorious, like he convinced the First Foundation that they won because they got this trade deal and it was all his doing or something like that, right? Very kind of superficial.
Some useless real estate.
Yeah. And then the Gaians, you know, are basically, you know, it's not clear to me how they are now on a path to kind of lead the galaxy, except that they just can kind of continue to expand their collective mindset across the universe or whatever.
Yeah, I didn't really get what their angle was. I thought it was more just that they could continue to exist. Like, they didn't have to worry about, like, the imminent destruction from either foundation.
Play for time. That's all you have. Sometimes that's all you can do.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
So,
they're political entities. I mean, like, you think about it. Brando wants to stay in power. Mm-hmm. Jendabal wants to be in power. Mm-hmm. And they can both go back to their political lives and play the politics. And so, like, that's a win for them, you know.
And Hoover
up the perks of office in my sort of quasi, you know, uniparty state.
Yeah. And Pellerat gets what he wants.
I almost felt like Pellerat's in hospice care. You know, it's like he knows her endearment to him will not last forever, but she's kind of committed to take care of him.
Some big Anna Nicole Smith vibe in this whole scenario right there.
She's all about that wafer.
Yeah, sugar daddy. Right. Business out here, sugar babying.
I don't know. I mean, like, I think it's interesting to look at, like, what happens with, like, the secondary characters almost, like, more than the primary characters, right? Like, we don't really know what happened to Codell, right? He just kind of was like, oh, yeah, cool. Mission accomplished, chief.
Well, you got tweaked, like, right? Their brains got tweaked. They were all high-fiving back to the First Foundation.
But even still, like, it was kind of like anticlimactic that he was even along. You know what I mean? Well, like, we can't. He was kind of like set up to be this, like, you know, like how like the first lieutenant.
Too much into Lionel. He never really was set up to, like, you know.
I don't know. Well, he was
in the picture. It could have been him as the big reveal, but, you know.
Right. I was rooting for him. Security officer, right? And so then, like, that immediately paints him in the image of, like, okay, this is like the scary lieutenant that's scarier than the big bad, right? That's kind of how I read him. Like, okay, this is the guy who's got the secret police.
Yeah, who knows where, like, the bodies are buried.
Running around, and he knows where all the bodies were buried to, like, keep, you know, his girl Brano in power, essentially. So I was kind of like waiting for his manipulations to come out, you know.
Most importantly, he's a mustachioed pipe smoker.
Yeah.
I forgot
about that whole mustache battle. That's
the most important thing.
Who has the
Lionel?
Right.
I don't know. My fanfic about Codell is he's going to be kind of this sleeper who's really pulling all the strings behind the scenes.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And he's actually a robot. And he's the robot boss.
Mustachioed robot.
Telling Bliss and Gaia what to do. Exactly. Pipe-smoking mustachioed robot with an eye patch.
Everyone asks him.
The guy and the parrot on his shoulder. The worst kind of mustachioed robot. The pipe-smoking one.
Yeah, so I got fooled by Codell. I thought he was going to be a bigger character than he was. But, I mean, at least he was there with us in the end, which was nice, you know. Because Asimov set up Codell as this kind of, like, sleeper character of Brano, but then in the other hand was actually Nasuri Nova was really the sleeper character for Jindabal.
Yeah, he made his way back.
I'm almost disappointed with, like, the level of which, like, Novi played, right? Like, she was like a conduit, right? But it's like she was kind of like an empty vessel, you know what I mean? And that's boring.
Like, sort of. I mean, she's like a functionary, I guess. Mm-hmm. Guy in functionary, a certain,
like,
way.
Like an actuary?
Well, you know, going back to your prior point, you know, if it had been Panthro Codell on the plane.
But other than that, I think she played a pretty big part. I don't think she was completely an empty vessel.
Yeah, no. Totally. you know.
She was the voice of Gaia. But I mean,
the whole time, every single stage along the way, you know, she was a patsy. And how much of what she was doing was sort of influencing things at the time. That's unclear. Yeah. They don't
say it. It wasn't until she was lit by the proximity of the Gaian mentalic field, right?
Right.
That's what ultimately lit her up when she got close enough, right?
Yeah, it's like activated. Or she turned on, essentially. Mm-hmm. Right. And the whole time we kind of like speculated that she was like doing subtle manipulations here and there. And just doesn't seem like that was the case, right? Like she just kind of was like, you know, yes, master.
But she still played
master,
an active part in the scheme, which makes me believe that even if she wasn't conscious of her part, she was still kind of like being puppeted by
she was like programmed
her
to be
Gaian
fawning.
Influence. Whatever it was, like she was in the right spot at the right. I mean, how many of her did they plant in the Hamish society? Was every other Hamish a Gaian agent? Or was she the one who was meant to be there when these Hamish were influenced by some Gaian mentalic field to jump Gendabal, right?
30 like, or 50 of the 30 or 50 of the third foundationers around the entire planet.
Just definitely no coverage. More than 75, right?
Well, but regardless, like,
it only takes 50. You know,
but to your point, they make the point that the second foundationers don't ever go outside because, like, Gendabal was jogging and it was like this, you know, he's a man of
jogging. He's jogging. Earth. It's a
jogging.
Soft
J. Yes. not on Tranters. Not, it's nothing but hard steel. The only hard constants the entire planet around.
It's just farmland.
But yeah, I mean, like,
you
it doesn't
trip
seem
over
like it
metal
that great
shards
coverage.
In it's, the ground. Yeah,
they're all just living at, you know, one second foundation way, second foundation headquarters. Like, you probably need like two guys in a van. Like, just spoken. There's not like scoping them out because they don't seem to like be spread out. They don't seem to go outside. They don't seem to mingle. Like, they just go to their scholar location. Call in, you know, mail order Hamish people and work at the table. Like, there doesn't seem like that they're like out and about.
But they're convinced that they're controlling everything in the universe.
It's a busy job. Being
I like to think of them as Hamish.
Being a paternalistic sort of like self-involved overlord.
Yeah. Never go outside like their house, but they're controlling the entire universe. Makes perfect sense.
Only the ivoriest tower for me and my associates, please.
And there we have it. We've been left with a peaceful resolution, at least for now. A promise of help for Trevise by our affectionately known Third Foundation, or Gaia. And then the hunt for Earth continues. So I guess we'll find out what happens in our next season. And before that, we have our season finale. And it's been a pleasure. Thank you for joining us tonight. I've been Peter, your host, along with my beautiful co-hosts.
Dan from Los Angeles.
And Jason from Florida.
And we will see you guys soon. Have a great night, everyone.
Good night.
Bye-bye.